A catastrophic tsunami rising out of the Pacific. Its huge waves sweeping away everything in its path. A massive wall of water that rose 30 feet in the heart of Japan.
Shaken violently, part of the ceiling of the terminal building fell.
This is from our camera reporter in Miyagi. And it looks like the tsunami has engulfed several cities in Miyagi Prefecture.
At the Sendai Airport, it took only 30 seconds for water to overtake the runways. Soon after, the 16-foot airport tunnel overflowed, filling with cars.
Japan is a nation in aftershock. The big quake was 3 days ago, but the tremors keep on coming.
This thing has been a strong quake.
Yeah, yeah.
We're telling people to move out of the area. Yeah.
We just arrived in Idohama village when the police said it was time to leave. That's not a warning that anyone here takes lightly, though this one turned out to be a false alarm. All along this stretch of battered coastline, they're on edge, even as they count the cost of last Friday's quake. On the bridge to the town of Iwanuma, we met Shuko Aizawa. She's lost her 99-year-old mother. For 2 days, she's searched the evacuation camps. Now she's come to look in her mother's house. But it isn't here anymore. In fact, she can't work out where it was, because the entire place has been lifted off its foundations and washed away. She finds a photo and thinks it might be a neighbor. And these curtains look like the ones in her mother's house, but she can't be sure.
It's all flattened. Without the houses here, I don't recognize anything at all.
There was an early warning in Iwanuma, an evacuation, but the very elderly would have struggled to make it. While we were there, they found two bodies. This man dragged from his car where the churning water had picked it up and dumped it. They didn't stand a chance against the same force of nature that carried this house half a mile down the road and into a petrol station. We made it to Fujitsuka village not long after the rescue teams arrived.
They've just started the search for bodies here today, but as you can see, it's an impossible task because the entire village is still inundated.
They insist their priority is still to search for signs of life.
Have you found any survivors?
Our team hasn't found anyone surviving.
In places like Fujitsuka, the tragedy of this disaster isn't just the lives lost, but that it's now so difficult to imagine that anyone ever lived.
That was only you and me. We were young and wild and free. Now nothing can take you away from me. We've been down that road before, but that's over now. Think you may come in back for more.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Community FM.
Absolutely. Good evening. It's just after 8 o'clock today, the 15th of March, 2011. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM with me, Syed Ahmed, and Tariq Ziad. Just at the beginning of the show, you heard these news footages. Footages provided to us by Al Jazeera, Sky News, and various other media outlets. Thank you very much to them. A very, very tragic event that took place on Friday in Japan, as we all seen the horrifying footages on our television screen and on our internet and on our papers. Today's show, Behind the Headlines, is dedicated to these people of Japan who have lost their loved ones and people who are still grieving and still looking for their loved ones. It's an event, it makes you think about life in a whole new, it just gives a whole new outlook to life. On Friday morning when we woke up, we never envisaged watching scenes like this on our television screen. It's horrifying, it is devastating, and in this hour of need, the people of Japan, we stand by them, and likewise, I'm sure our Unity FM listeners also stand by with the people of Japan, and you know, we grieve with them for their loss. It could have happened to any of us.
Okay, sorry, just quickly, we've actually got a guest caller on the phone.
We do have, yes.
This guest caller, if you could second. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, yes. We have two guest callers here, I do apologise for this. If you want to introduce this.
Well, the first article, actually, Tariq, just to get on with the show. On Sunday, the yes. Sunday Mercury printed an article.
Right.
About this 3-year-old child who's been treated in Birmingham, one of the NHS Trust hospitals, mm-hmm. With a booze addiction. Now, if you could just read us the article, and the writer of this article will be joining us very, very shortly, Ben Golby.
Yes.
I was speaking to Ben very, very shortly, and I think some of what he has to say could be rather disturbing with the findings he's made. So if you could just give us a brief scenario.
This is from the Birmingham Mail. It says that a 3-year-old child has been treated for alcoholism at Birmingham Hospital. The youngster is one of 13 children aged 12 and under who were diagnosed as alcoholic by the Heart of England NHS Trust between 2008 and 2010. The children are at serious risk of brain damage. Figures released under the Freedom of Information Act have also revealed that a further 106 teenagers aged 13 to 16 were treated for being addicted to booze at the Trust during the same period, and 74 kids aged 13 to 16 were admitted to A&E for emergency treatment for alcohol abuse by Heart of England medics.
Well, there you are, you heard it. Now, it makes you think, doesn't it, that what actually goes on and what, you know, the kind of society we are living in. And it's a sad, sad story that we had to, a 3-year-old. Joining me on the line is Ben Golby from Birmingham Mail and Sunday Mercury. Good evening, Ben.
Good evening, hi.
And thank you very much for joining us at Unity FM. Now, Ben, I had this article sent to me by a friend and a colleague of mine yesterday. Can you tell us a little bit more about the article itself and how you actually, and the findings you've made during writing this article?
Yes, well, I mean, as your reporter there outlined, the original figures came from a Freedom of Information request, and that went into the Heart of England NHS Trust, which runs Heartland, Good Hope and Solihull Hospitals in Birmingham. And basically, we wanted to find out, we understood that there was a problem with alcoholism affecting younger and younger children. Obviously, we were completely shocked to find out that it was children this young. I mean, I've got a niece who's coming up to 3 years old. I can't even imagine a 3-year-old child becoming... And we clarified this with them, addicted to alcohol, not just treated for finding some alcohol in dad's cupboard or something like that. You know, they were actually treated for an addiction to it. So I think surprise was kind of our main emotion at first. And then we started to dig a little bit deeper, and we spoke to a few charities, and they were saying that, you know, this is a problem in some homes. You know, some children are left at the kind of the mercy of alcoholic parents, or just completely not given a chance. So it's a very surprising story.
Well, I mean, yes, we did contact the relevant authorities, and you mentioned a few charities in your article, actually, Ben. We also contacted Birmingham Children's Social Services to actually see if they had any comments. Obviously, they declined, and they didn't actually come on. But, Ben, why, I mean, are we turning into a society of alcoholics and drunkards? I mean, what is it? I mean, why this kind of activity that's going on in front of our eyes, and what can we actually do about it?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to say. I think one of the most surprising things about these figures was that this was by no means an isolated case. I mean, you alluded to it there when you read the article out.
Mm.
There were 13 other children under the age of 12. I mean, under 12s getting their hands on alcohol. I mean, there's no way that these kids are looking 18. There's no way that they could be buying it from a reputable wholesaler or from a pub. So how are they getting their hands on this alcohol? I mean, it seems that it must be a breakdown in the family unit. So, as you say, you contact the social services. I mean, that's an issue. But I think it's a broader problem of a culture of young drinking that's kind of been allowed to spiral out of control, and then it's filtering down younger and younger.
Yes, and I mean, we see sometimes alcohol is being promoted on television and other media outlets. How much of an influence do you think that these adverts and these media influence have on young drinkers?
I mean, it's got to have some influence. I mean, when you look at the culture of things like alcopops, which are kind of, I'm not suggesting for a minute that they're all marketed at children, but what I'm saying is that it kind of brings in, you know, it looks like any other drink. It doesn't look like a pint of beer. It looks like a bottle of Cherryade or a bottle of... You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
I think that's a problem. You know, I think the marketing is a problem, but I think the cheapness of the alcohol is also an issue. You know, I mean, when we spoke to the local MP, Laurelie Burt, she said that you know, you can get lager cheaper in some supermarkets than you can get
a bottle of water, yes.
So, I mean, I think it's... I think if we allow it to kind of permeate into our adult culture, obviously it will filter down to younger people and it will become more acceptable. And I think we're kind of seeing the backdraft of that, as it were.
I mean, you also quoted, you also wrote on this article, Ben, that last year alone, West Midlands Ambulance Services dealt with quite a lot of calls regarding alcohol injuries with alcohol under the age of 16, and a lot of these there are more girls than boys who actually needed the treatment from the A&E.
Yeah, and those figures were compiled by Alcohol Concern, who are one of the charities that we spoke to regarding the article. I mean, it's a sad fact of life, I think, that these days if you go into an A&E department on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, if you break your hand or you know, you have a bump in your car or whatever, you will see that it's almost entirely filled with young, very young adults, you know, teenagers and kids in their sort of early 20s with alcohol-related issues. So, I mean, it's not... To think of it as just an isolated number, you know, just an isolated three-year-old, it's not that. It's a deeper culture, and I mean, that's got to be kind of tackled root and branch. I don't think you can tackle that with one measure.
I mean, this issue with alcohol, Ben, I mean, is it a problem just in the West Midlands, or is it a growing problem throughout the country?
Not at all. I think the West Midlands is, you know, it's an area that suffers with it, but I think those Alcohol Concern figures show that it's a wider problem. It's in London, it's in Manchester, Sheffield, all over the place. And I don't think that there's anything we can do today, tomorrow, next week. I think we need to tackle the whole binge drinking culture, the idea of drinking just to get drunk, that sort of thing. It's in the education, it's in families, it's in schools, and it will all move up from there, hopefully. But I think it's something that needs to be prioritised now, because it's taking a huge toll on the NHS, it's taking a huge toll on the ambulance service, and obviously it's taking a huge toll on children's health.
Well, absolutely, and you know, these are figures that what you have. I mean, they're rather frightening. By all means, and the thing is, you know, Ben, that those binge drinking culture, I mean, in Birmingham alone, I speak, and you find kids on the street corner having nowhere to go, nothing to do because of cutback in services. Do you think a lot of that, and being with a certain crowd of people, peer pressure, do you think that has any effect on it?
Well, I mean, that's what we're hearing. I stress that I'm not an expert. You know, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a psychologist. I don't treat anyone. You know, I'm just a journalist who looked into the issue. But I mean, what we found was that it's a whole combination of things. But like you say, you know, there is a lot of despair in culture at the moment. You know, there's economic problems that might be forcing younger teenagers who, you know, can't see any future for themselves in the job market, etc. You know, alcohol can be a crutch for people like that. But I mean, equally, like you say, it can be, just be a boredom issue. I mean, it can just be a, you know, my friends are doing it, there's nothing else for me, so I will join in.
But I mean, is it only, I mean, I know we're concentrating on this young child, which I think shocked many of us when we've seen your article. But is it only a problem we're having with alcohol, or there are other problems like drug-related, hard drugs, things like cannabis or Class A substance?
Well, I mean, these figures relate strictly to alcohol, so I mean, it would just be me speculating on something like that. But I mean, obviously, there are problems with other drugs in society. I don't know how young those figures would suggest. I mean, maybe that's you give me a good idea there. Maybe that's something I should look into next. Mm. But I think with the alcohol figures, I know that is an eye-catching figure that a three-year-old would be. Will become addicted to alcohol, but I think it's important that we look deeper than that and we look at the fact that, like you've read out earlier, you know, 100 other children under 16, I mean, these are children, again, that would never be served alcohol in an off-licence or in a pub, so they're getting their hands on it somehow, and I think maybe that's something that social services, police, all the way through, would need to look at to try and establish it and tackle it, really.
Absolutely. I mean, as a society and as a whole, though, do you think, I mean, we all have a part to play in what's actually going on today with the binge drinking? I mean, now they've got 24-hour licensing for a lot of the pubs as well. That really doesn't help the situation because you could, I mean, parents at home could be drinking. That actually is a bigger influence on the offsprings. I mean, do you have any of that have any issues with it?
I mean, I think something like 24-hour drinking was kind of introduced with the best of intent, which was to try and stop the 11 o'clock outpouring of pubs onto the streets and to stop the violence and the policing and ambulance costs that kind of went along with that. So they're trying to stagger that and make sure that you don't have that one focal point for trouble. So I can kind of understand that. I think if parents are drinking, if binge drinking is something that happens in the home and happens with their older sister or with their cousin or whatever, you know, kids are going to be more likely to think that that's an acceptable route for them to take. So I think, as with most things, you know, it starts with the family. But yeah, I think social services has a role to play. Maybe legislation has a role to play. Certainly, I think the idea of putting a minimum price on drink.
Do you think, though, you know, sorry for interrupting you there, Ben, but do you think putting a minimum price on alcohol such as lager or wine or even spirit, do you think that could actually help? I mean, we thought the 24-hour licensing would actually cut down a lot of binge drinking and, you know, things like that. But, you know, obviously the problem hasn't gone away and the media itself had a bigger role to play in it. So do you think a minimum charge on a can of alcohol, do you think that could make the difference?
I think when you're in a situation where lager is cheaper than water, that you have to look at every alternative because, I mean, that's unsustainable. That will lead to, you know, economic factors taking over and people choosing alcohol because it's a cheap option. If we can take that off the table, then maybe we can start... You know, maybe we can start looking to make some progress that way. I think it's worth exploring, but I would hasten to add that I haven't seen any legislation or seen anything put down in writing. So I think that's one for the politicians to discuss. Really.
Absolutely, absolutely, and hopefully, you know, we will. I mean, that issue certainly wouldn't go away. And you know, if there's more development, I hope you'll keep us informed, Ben. And we'll even try and get a word with the MP if we can, and see what they are actually planning on doing regarding these issues.
Okay.
Ben Colby from Birmingham Mail and Sunday Mercury, thank you very much for joining us this evening and
thanks
for giving us your time. And hopefully we will speak soon.
Thanks.
Hope this time we'll have a more pleasant news for us.
Let's hope so. Okay.
Thank you,
much,
Ben Colby. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Go. never heard of a plan to fly hijacked jets into landmarks on the East Coast. East Coast. East Coast. East Coast.
We're going to take a closer look tonight at another example of where, despite the conventional wisdom, there were people in the United States who actually were preparing to defend against the kind of attacks which occurred here on 9/11. On 9/11. On 9/11. North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD for short, has been defending the skies over the U.S. and Canada for almost 50 years. 50 years. 50 years. 50 years. NORAD conducted exercises using hijacked airliners as weapons. One target was the World Trade Center.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
My time.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
93.5 Unity FM. Guys, I want your calls on this. 0121 772 8892. 0121 772 8892. Alcohol. What role does it play in our society? You heard there a 3-year-old child who is addicted to alcohol. Who does the blame lie with? Society itself, social background. I want your calls. 0121 772 8892. And of course, anything else you hear on the program as well. Our Facebook page is up and running, Behind the Headlines. Just go onto that, drop your comments if you don't want to come on the phone. Or even the text line is working, 0792 684 3388. And like I said, Facebook page, Behind the Headlines. We're going to go to another interesting story now. Positive money, Tariq.
Not so much a story, but Positive Money are a campaign run by Ben Dyson, based in London. They campaign for monetary reform, and they've got an excellent website, which is www.positivemoney.org.uk, where they give you a wealth of information about the economic system, the current banking system. I'm going to play you a video here, which is called "The Money: How Money is Created and How Banking Works," which is by Ben Dyson himself. So have a listen to this. It's a very, very educational thing on the realities of banking.
We all know there's something seriously wrong with money and banking at the moment. We've just been through one of the biggest crises in decades, and nobody seems to be able to find a solution. So before we talk about what's wrong with the system and how we fix it, we just want to emphasize the importance of money. Now, money isn't one of those things that you can leave to economists and mathematicians. It determines everything that happens in your life. If you were going to build a house, you probably wouldn't choose to build it on a foundation of sand. You could build the most elaborate house you could imagine, but you know what's going to happen sooner or later. Now, money is the foundation of the economy. In the same way that you need a firm foundation for your house, you need a firm foundation for the economy. Money is the foundation of the economy and society. If money breaks down, then society can break down as well. Now, here's the banking system in 2006. You had this incredibly elaborate system, you know, amazing profits. It seemed like they could turn paper into gold. And here's the banking system in 2010. Now, we don't think it has to be like this. We think it's possible to create a banking system that's stable, sustainable, a system that's productive, and a system that's fair. But that isn't how the system is working at the moment. under the system at the moment, you have four ways of getting money. Okay, you can either work for it, you can beg for it, you can borrow money, or you could just go and steal it. Now, when we ask people which of these four options is the most important, work is usually the one that people opt for. Now, what you're going to find out over the next few minutes is that borrowing is far, far more significant than any other means of getting money into your pocket. And the reason why money is so important is because it simply determines everything that happens in your life. If you have it, you live well. If you have a lot of it, you live incredibly well. And if you don't, you end up begging at the side of the street, or in the worst possible scenario, you could starve. In fact, a developmental economist under the name of Amartya Sen discovered that when famines occur, it's not due to lack of food. It's due to a range of economic failures in the food distribution system, rising food prices, unemployment, declining wages. Now, a lot of people would point to that and say it's a failure of free markets. We'd probably say it's a failure of the money system. And when the money system breaks down, society starts to break down and people really suffer. And this is Weimar Republic, Germany. The money system broke down there in the 1920s. And you can see here, this was a 500 mark note, and the inflation in there was so severe that they simply had to print 1 million over this note. This is like having a £5 note and the government printing £2,000 over that note, and it's still only been worth enough to buy a couple of beers or a few loaves of bread. Okay. And more recently, Zimbabwe. Everybody's seen the scenes there, the entire, you know, the destruction, the poverty that was created by this money system breaking down alongside bad government. This is a $100 trillion note. And much more recently in America, you know, the banking system's broken down. People lose their jobs, people lose their houses, people end up on the streets begging for money. You know, the money system is absolutely critical to the health of the economy and to the health of society, and we cannot afford to screw it up. So, how well are we managing it now? How well is the system working now? Well, this is Mervyn King. He's the governor of the Bank of England, so he's the guy in charge. And this is what he had to say recently. Of all the many ways of organizing banking, the worst is the one we have today.
You just heard an excerpt of a video from positivemoney.org.uk, and you can listen to the full video and many more videos by going to that very, very website and get educated on the alternatives to cuts and slashes and, you know, paying back a deficit. We are quite short on time now, so I'm going to give out the number one more time. It's 0121-772-8892, and you just had a very interesting debate, of course, about the Daily Mail article. So if you want to call
Sunday Mercury.
And the Sunday Mercury. So if you want to call in about that, then please call in, share your views. We've got lots more interesting things to talk about.
Yeah. And, of course, the big tragedy unfolded on Friday in Japan, as you may have heard the news footage we played at the beginning of the show.
Okay, we'll be back after this.
Check out the basement.
listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.